Hello there. Are you sure you're in the right place? See the name on the door? This podcast is Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. Surely you don't want to come in here. You do. Well, I must warn you that things are pretty adult in here. Absolutely no children are allowed. Obscene language, shocking and horrendous stories to chill you to your core, and terrifying tales that'll keep you up at night. The ladies inside aren't quite right. Lovely and hilarious, but very strange. Still want in, do you? Well, you'll get what you're here for. Listener discretion is advised.
Before we start, we needed to let you guys know that we did actually record this podcast as a trio, but Tash hadn't turned her microphone on for the audio files. So I've had to edit this episode just as a duo between me and Becky. So there is no intro. It jumps straight into the stories. Luckily, we were also recording video and I should be able to get Tasha's segment of That's Gross and the entire intro of the podcast on video. So if you want to check that out, I will post it onto YouTube. Our YouTube channel is Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. And I'll also post it to our Facebook page, which is Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. Okay, I hope you enjoy the episode. The stories are awesome.
Hi, and welcome back to Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. I'm Becky.
And I'm Emma. Hi. Now we've got the issue with my multi-parters now because it's not once a week. So you guys probably don't even remember the story, do you? Okay. Bobby Mackey's Music House. No, Music World. Bobby and Janet have bought this building. It used to be a slaughterhouse with a big well and the blood and the dentist that murdered Pearl and chopped her head off. Got executed. Then it was a nightclub and one of the dancers there fell in love with a musician and her dad killed him. And then she committed suicide. All sorts of nasty shit happened after that. It was a Hard Rock Cafe. And now it's Bobby Mackey's Music World. Bish, bash, bosh.
Yes.
And do you remember Carl?
Yeah.
That's right.
And we were a bit unsure about him, weren't we? We didn't know. We were undecided.
When we left off last week, Janet had just been picked up. She'd just been attacked. She'd been picked up by Bobby and Carl had said it's probably best that you don't come back or stay away for a while. So she did indeed keep her distance and everything at Bobby Mackey's remained calm until one day Bobby had to go out of town for some business and he left Carl alone to work. He began to work when he was hit with a strong smell of roses.
Oh, yeah, I remember the strong smell of flowers.
His heart sank. What was about to happen? What do you want? He shouted, more annoyed than anything at this point. A voice coming from nowhere and everywhere at the same time said, get out.
Yeah.
But not in a scary way, more in a something nasty is coming, you'd better leave way. But there was no time. Before he knew it, glasses started flying at his head, bar stools started shaking and falling over, and a disgusting stench filled the air, followed by a maniacal laughter. Come and face me, Carl shouted. He's a braver man than me, because I'd be like, bye!
Yeah, if you're just going to be rude and throw glasses at me,
I'm leaving. Plus, you're a little bit smelly, so I'm off. But not Carl. Carl was being defiant and saying, come show yourself. Let's, kind of do this man-to-man type of thing. And he no doubt regretted that as he was grabbed and thrown across the room. As he picked himself up off the floor, he could make out the silhouette of a man. He knew this wasn't a living person, not like the first time he'd met Joanna. This man was kind of transparent. he had cold, psychotic eyes and a noose hanging from around his neck. Carl knew that his life was in danger, so he ran towards the door at full speed. Once outside, he looked up at the office window and saw two red glowing eyes staring back at him. He shuddered and looked back up, but the eyes were gone. He shouted, "I'll be back with holy water. You're going to leave this place, not me." He locked the front doors and jumped into his car. As he drove away, the accelerator pedal pushed itself right down and jammed. The car began to pick up more and more speed. Then his steering wheel turned itself into oncoming traffic. Just before Carl's car smashed into a huge lorry, the car filled with the smell of roses and he regained control. Swerving, he crashed into a ditch. Once the car was immobile, Carl just sat there stunned at what just happened. This was a blatant attack on his life, and outside of Mackie's. Did this mean he wasn't safe anywhere? He knew Joanna had saved him, but how long would she be able to keep him safe? Carl decided this needed to be taken care of that same night and planned to return to Bobby's armed with holy water. But the ghost of the building had other plans. Carl heard the loud sounds of his fire scanner go off. He was a volunteer firefighter. When he saw the address of the fire, his blood ran cold, 44 Licking Pike. The nightclub was ablaze. He rushed over as fast as he could to see the entire south wing was burning down. Bobby was stood in front of the crowd, watching the firefighters. So that whole part of the building was completely burnt away, nothing left. But Bobby, being the type of guy he is, refused to let it get him down. That part of the building wasn't going to be used, and as soon as they could get a clean-up crew in, they would demolish it and get right back to opening as planned. The fire department never could find a reason that the South Wing caught fire. And that's to this day. They don't know why. I think I might have an idea. I think it's Carl threatening them with holy water.
Like, this is what I think of your holy water.
Fire!
Fire!
What's the opposite of water? Fire!
Bobby and Carl went inside as soon as they were allowed, and Carl went to check everything in the office. The room was filled with smoke, but apart from that, everything seemed to have escaped the fire. He went to leave, and the door slammed in his face. He heard the same evil laughter fill the room, and a voice asked him, "Where's your holy water then?" Which is fucking horrible.
"Where's your holy water now, bitch?"
Carl was understandably terrified. I mean, this reads as some fictional horror book, but I have to keep reminding myself that this is a true story. Imagine a clear as day voice laughing and mocking you, threatening you, but you knew that no one was there.
You'd think you're going crazy, wouldn't you? You'd be like, is this
Am
just
I mental?
In yeah. my brain? Yeah.
Carl managed to ask, "Who are you?" And the answer came, "Alonzo." And the entity also admitted to starting the fire. He wanted to show Carl that there was no way he would get hit, him or any of the others to leave. And there were plenty of other spirits inside the walls of Bobby Mackie's music world. That was enough for Carl, and he decided now would be a great time to get the fuck out. Which, yeah, I'm with him. The door was now cooperating, and he left rather swiftly. Really, all Carl wanted to do was to leave that awful building and never, ever look back. But he felt some kind of responsibility to Janet and Bobby. He felt like he had a connection with the spirits there and that maybe he could protect the couple. I don't know, it's odd. He was definitely dedicated, considering he's only just met these guys. But as we'll see, maybe at this point there was already something more sinister at work than just Carl's desire to be kind. After the fire, Janet decided to come back and help clean and prepare for opening. Carl was surprised to see her back, but she seemed confident she'd be all right. He left her dusting the top office while he went to get some boxes from the basement. The office filled with the smell of roses. Carl smelt it from the basement and started to run toward the door, but it was jammed shut. He then heard a sound like a heartbeat that became so loud he had to cover his ears. Janet felt the icy cold grasp of something wrap itself around her and squeeze hard down on her baby bump. She struggled to get free, but it was useless. She was yet again swung around the room whilst the office door slammed open and shut repeatedly. She broke free and made a run for the steps, only to be violently shoved halfway down, falling the rest of the way. Carl was living his own nightmare in the basement. He was trying his hardest to get out, to check on Janet, but also was dealing with what can only be described as pure evil. In a mirror, a red bloody face appeared with glowing red eyes. There was no skin, just rotting flesh that fell off out of the mirror and onto the floor, making a wet splat noise as it did. The demonic face identified itself as the Morning Star and began growling and laughing.
The Morning Star just reminds me of the Teletubby sun. I don't know why.
Morning Star, yeah, but that's another name.
Star.
That's another name for the devil.
Oh, is it? That's why it makes sense.
Have you never seen...
Makes me think of the Teletubbies baby, though.
Have you never seen Lucifer?
No, it's on my list of series to watch.
Well, his full name is Lucifer Morningstar.
Ah, but it sounds so pretty.
Morningstar is another name for the devil. So he's got this horrendous, like, flayed face with chunks of flesh falling out through the mirror, like, and splashing as they fall, which is horrendous, right? I think that's probably one of the most horrendous things I've read in a haunting. So, and it begins growling and laughing terrifyingly while its bits of face are falling off. Now, whether this was real or a hallucination, I don't know, because Carl says it's real, but that's a lot, right? But I do think Carl had begun a downward spiral into the depth of insanity.
That's scary also. Imagine kind of half realising that you're starting to go crazy. But then also if you start seeing things like that, it kind of, I wouldn't blame him. It makes him go a bit nuts.
No, exactly. But I don't know. He could have seen it. I don't know. I'm just saying for me, of all the ghost stories I've ever read, I've never heard of something so horrendous. The face disappeared as quickly as it had appeared, and the door flung open, leaving Carl to run and check on Janet. She was sat, dazed, on a bar stool. She said something had pushed her down the stairs. She held her stomach as she spoke. She was, for lack of a better word, traumatised. Carl took her outside and Bobby came to pick her up. She tried to explain to him what had happened, that she was attacked and had been forced down the stairs, but Bobby just couldn't accept the reality of ghosts. Nonetheless, he of course took her home and cared for her. She woke up early the next morning knowing something was very wrong. She felt like she'd gone into labour, but she couldn't, surely. After all, she was only starting her 6 month of pregnancy. Janet was taken to hospital and she did indeed give birth. The baby and Janet were both fine after a while, of course. With such a premature baby, I think she was only like a pound and a few ounces. She was
a little baby.
Diddy.
Teeny tiny.
So the baby had to stay in hospital for a month, but both survived. I can't help thinking that this is not a coincidence. The building seemed determined to harm Janet's unborn baby. Relentless, even. And we've got a bit of a... Pearl was 5 months pregnant. Joanna was 5 months pregnant.
Mm.
And Janet was just entering her 6 month. So, I don't know. Bit of a coinkydink. Bobby was still having absolutely none of the ghostly attacks, and after learning that Carl had also had encounters, he kindly asked him never to speak of them again with Janet. I think Bobby is frightened that if news gets out that there are ghosts in his club, I mean, he genuinely doesn't believe in ghosts, but if news gets out, then he thinks people are frightened and they're not going to come. So he's really trying to nip it in the bud. So he asked Carl not to talk about it anymore with anyone, and especially Janet. He didn't want Carl's stories frightening away business or clouding his wife's mind. He told Carl that if he didn't stop, he would have to look for his replacement.
Yeah.
Carl promised he would stop, but knew that he had to do something to get the evil out of there. But he would just have to do it alone, without Bobby finding out. Bobby was often at hospital with Janet and the baby, leaving the building empty, so it could be the perfect opportunity for Carl to cleanse the place. He was being plagued by horrendous visions during the day and nightmares at night. He was clearly under some kind of spiritual attack. I didn't write this down, but at one point he's like in some kind of a closet and the door jams and he can't get out. And he turns round and there's like a dwarf in there with him, but like a corpse of a dwarf. But like rotting and
his face is rotting. Oh, what's with the rotting faces?
I know. And all his teeth were falling out and he was like kind of coming towards Carl from the darkness. Like, but I didn't put that in because I was like, Carl, are you just a bit mental at this point? Because that seems...
like a dream. It's sort of...
yeah. If that kind of shit was really going on, then surely by now we would have definite proof that ghosts exist and the paranormal's real because we've got, like, possessed dwarf corpses popping out of closets.
Yeah, and glasses flying around. Yeah.
But it doesn't make it less scary for him because he's going through it, whether it's in his mind or not. I think he's losing the plot a little bit.
You think how scary full-on hallucinations must be? How terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's going on? I feel like he's written every single horror film that exists ever.
That's why in the book it's portrayed as actually really happening, and I'm... it's just a lot. It's just a lot. Janet and her new baby girl were allowed home after a month. The damage from the fire had been dealt with, and it was now finally time to open Bobby Mackie's Music World. Do, 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 do. This did not mean that the paranormal happenings had come to a stop, even in the slightest.
Did anything go on to the denier who's always denying that everything's happened?
What, Bobby?
Yeah.
No, and to this day, I think he's still alive. I know that Carl has sadly passed away, and I think Janet's passed away as well. But no, nothing ever happened to Bobby. Nothing.
It's weird, isn't it?
But it did, though, because it did and it didn't, because he did see Joanna, didn't he? In the first part of the story, he was showing the building round to Janet, he saw a woman and he was going, "Hey, lady, come back." And then he was like, "Oh, imagining it. I was just daydreaming." But bit weird. Carl had an encounter with the spirit of Buck Brady, the owner of the building when it was called the Primrose. In a The Shining-esque meeting, have you seen The Shining?
Yes.
Carl had been closing up and had looked up to see the apparition stood behind the bar. He was a nice-looking guy, not scary, and yet he had a foreboding warning for Carl. Under the floorboards in the basement was a well that had been used to summon the devil, and this now acted as a gateway to hell. Carl wanted more information, but the apparition just dissipated into nothing.
You're not getting any more information. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Time to go. But that
you know, in The Shining, where there's the ghostly barman, that's kind of what that reminded me of. Terrifying film, that one. One evening after closing and everyone had gone home, a police officer named Hornsby was doing his rounds and thought he saw a figure in a window of the building. The door appeared to be open, and so he thought it best to go and investigate, after he called for backup, of course, because he thought there might be an intruder. They entered and saw nothing. Everything was quiet, and then, as if somebody had flicked a switch, the music started playing from the jukebox and the place filled with the chatter of people. The pair of officers were dumbfounded. What they could hear just didn't match up with this big, empty nightclub. They then heard the slam of the front doors and everything fell silent again. The officers decided that if anyone had been there, they'd gone now and that they should probably leave too.
Looks like everyone's gone. We should leave. Nope, nothing going on here. Bye. Going now. I agree.
Ormsby didn't include the ghostly music and voices in his report, as he would have become the laughingstock at the station. But he swears he knows exactly what he and his colleague experienced that night. This would not be Officer Hornsby's last experience at Bobby Mackey's. Just a few days later, he arrived in the car park where a woman had lost control of her car and smashed into a pole. The accident had been fatal, and as the woman lay dead on the ground, he thought he should cover the body whilst waiting for the ambulance. He felt a tap on his shoulder, and he turned round to see a woman offering him a tablecloth. He thanked her and covered up the poor woman's body. After the emergency services had left, he went back to the club to thank the woman again for her help, only to find everything locked up. He went back the next day and asked Bobby about the woman. Bobby said the woman didn't fit the description of any of his employees and that the bar had been shut anyway at the time of the accident. Officer Hornsby was now convinced that he had met one of the spirits that inhabit Bobby Mackey's music world.
Mm.
It's a powerful name, isn't it?
You know, I could just hear him saying, Bobby Mackey's music world, yeah.
Mm. You sound like Cartman. You did, you sounded like Cartman.
I don't think I'll be able to do it again.
Carl has now moved into the club in an apartment on the upper floor. Because that sounds like a great idea. Like, he's having all these horrible experiences inside. Let's live there forever.
I'll just move in. Yeah.
Yeah, just live there. Love it. This, of course, meant that he spent a lot of time alone inside at night. But he wasn't overly bothered. He felt a weird connection to Bobby Mackey's, like he was supposed to be there, protecting it. Shortly after the grand opening, he was searching for something in the stock rooms and tripped on a loose floorboard. As he moved the piece of wood aside, he found a diary hidden under the floor. He couldn't believe it as he read the name of the author, Joanna. This corroborated everything he had experienced. There was indeed the spirit of a woman named Joanna, and her story was everything Carl had been told. She had committed suicide after thinking her father had killed her lover, Robert Randall. The last lines of the diary said that she would stay here roaming the club until she was reunited with her lost love. So that's a bit freaky.
Yeah.
Because we've got to remember, we know the history of the place. Carl doesn't. So he's got the right name, the right event, everything, and he's found it in this diary, and it's all correct. So maybe Carl's a bit mental, but not entirely mental.
Yeah. For some reason, I thought you were going to find a box of teeth under the floorboards.
Ugh.
Ugh.
Gross.
Teeth.
After reading every page that night, he turned over to go to sleep. But there was a storm outside and it tripped the electrics.
I know.
Can you just imagine the nightmare scenario? You're alone in this massive building that's haunted as fuck with evil things with flesh falling off them and the electrics have just gone.
Mm. I got scared just turning the lights off yesterday. I had to run to my room.
He drags himself out of bed to go down to the basement, because that's where the fucking meter is, in the basement, armed with only a torch.
See? Horror movie again.
Yeah. He fumbled about trying to make his way around. He drops the torch and it rolls
away.
Fuck me.
And then it breaks. And then it breaks.
It kind of rolls away from him. As he picks it up, he sees a latch that he's never noticed before. So what does he do? He opens it up. He opens the hatch and he couldn't believe what he was seeing. The well.
There's a well. No!
The gateway to hell that Buck Brady had warned him about. He then heard a blood-curdling scream come from under his feet, coming from the well.
That's that woman from The Ring is going to come out.
Well, it might be Pearl because her head is supposedly down there, so.
Heads can't climb.
Heads can't climb. Oh, but what if they could?
Oh, with their teeth.
Imagine.
Honk, honk, honk. Oh, worse. Horrible.
Imagine all the inside heady bits. Oh, like
wiggly.
Wiggly. And they're just like a spider head.
Well, like in Oh, The Thing.
I've not seen that.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh. Is there a spider head?
Yeah, there is. Exactly that. You should definitely watch it, Emma.
I should write movies.
Yeah.
As he turned to leave, he was met with two male figures. He couldn't make out their features, but he knew they were menacing. And that's all he remembers. Next thing he knew, he was waking up on the basement floor and it was light outside. He must have blacked out or something. Understandably shaken, he pulled himself together, went back to his flat to retrieve some holy water that he'd been planning to use, and he threw it down the well, in the hopes of trapping whatever evil lurked down there.
Begone!
He decided against mentioning any of this to Bobby, who had made clear his stance on the paranormal. But the incident had left him feeling very strange. And this didn't go unnoticed by those around him either. They said he seemed to drastically change. He was always so cheery and laid back, and now he seemed constantly angry and stressed out. It got so bad that Bobby said he never knew which Carl he was going to be speaking to day to day. Janet was obviously convinced that Carl had something supernatural and sinister going on, but Bobby thought that they'd just both gone crazy.
Yeah, both crazy. Everybody crazy.
He did confide in one of his friends, though, Doug Hensley, a journalist who had come to help him film an ad for the club. Bobby told him everything, and although Doug was a non-believer, he found the whole story fascinating and asked if he could speak to Janet and Carl. He interviewed them both, and with all the information, he started researching the property. He was surprised to find so much violent history about the place. He read all about Pearl Bryant's murder and the execution of Jackson and Wailing, Alonzo Wailing. Doug began to wonder if the two mean figures that Carl had seen in the basement could be the ghosts of these two murderers. He found a lot of evidence about the place being used for devil worship and sacrifices being thrown down the well. Once he finished his investigation, he was somewhat more of a believer and told Bobby that they should definitely do something to get rid of any evil that was inside. Bobby, knowing his friend was a level-headed guy, he agreed. I didn't say believed, but he did agree, just in case whatever Doug came up with would help his wife and Carl. They had a psychic come. She didn't know any of the history of the building, but instantly picked up on a spirit called Joanna. She also looked down in the well and fell backwards, saying that there was a head down there, the head of a woman. She had to leave after being made to feel so ill, but returned a few hours later after she'd composed herself. She sat down with everyone and noticed that Carl was shaking. She could also see two men stood behind him, who emanated evil. She said she believed that they were oppressing Carl, wearing him down to the point where they could possess his body, and that they should get a minister to help him before the possession really took hold. Doug took it upon himself to find a minister, and a few days later he arrived at the club to talk with Carl. Upon entering, the minister said he had never felt such a deep and disturbing evil in all his career. He strongly suspected that the presence inside was demonic, and if Carl had been living here with it, which he had, then he would need help straight away. The minister sat down with Carl and began praying. Instantly, Carl's face changed into a distorted grin. He announced his name was Alonzo and that he prayed to know God. The voice coming out of Carl was not his own. He spoke in Latin and in another language that no one understood. It wasn't until later that they realised he was speaking English backwards, exclaiming, Natas ma'ai, Natas ma'ai, which, when you put it the right way round, I am Satan. This went on for 6 hours, with Carl behaving violently, screaming in what appeared to be two voices at the same time, and shouting profanities at the minister. After all that time, Carl finally collapsed on the floor, only to awaken to see everybody around him staring. So poor Carl, he's woken up, everybody's staring at him. He's got no idea what's gone on for the past 6 hours, no recollection whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, if you go on YouTube and search Carl Lawson exorcism, it's on YouTube.
Oh, well, that sounds horrible and I'm not going to look it up.
I've watched it and I can tell you it's not very nice. But when he woke up, he felt himself again and at peace. He also felt no more attachment to the building and, as any sane person would, decided to leave Bobby Mackie's music world in search of new employment. Janet didn't feel comfortable being there without Carl, and so she decided she would now stay at home with her new baby and avoid the club at all costs. Bobby Mackie still doesn't believe in ghosts, but he had to put a sign in the club saying, "Warning to our patrons, this establishment is reported to be haunted. Management is not responsible and cannot be held liable for any actions of any ghosts or spirits on this premise." After someone tried to sue him after being punched in the face by a ghost.
So I don't think he's like, he doesn't own the ghosts.
Of course, the news of the haunting got out and has since been on multiple ghost hunting TV programs. Zach Baggins has been there. And it has become notorious in the paranormal community. Bobby's new motto is, "Come for the ghosts, stay for the music." There you go. Bobby Mackie's Music World.
Well, thank you so much for your story. It was intense at times.
It was very...
And I think I kind of like the mix of the whole possible mental illness with ghosts, because I imagine both would make each other worse.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He could have been under some kind of influence, you know, spiritual influence, making him see all sorts of horrendous shite.
What he saw, though, was horrible.
Horrible.
Horrendous stuff.
Awful.
And to answer your question, yes, I do have murder because that's my job in this podcast.
It's what you do.
All right. So on December 15th, 1982, Frank Smith was pondering about what he should do on his day's activities. He lived in the town of Morton, Mississippi, and he worked in construction. And that day it was pouring down with rain, so he knew that he was going to get the day off because where they were working, it needed not to be rainy. So he called his friend John Dolan and asked if he wanted to do a bit of the old metal detector treasure hunting with him. So he was like, "Sounds like a plan, Batman."
I love metal detector. Love it. The only thing that stops me from doing metal detecting is because this area was so affected in World War II. Yeah. I would be worried about what I would find that might explode in my face.
Nah, it's best to be staying in a field. So John was down for this plan. So they both ran to their sheds and got out their metal detectors because they love to look for war relics and coins. So that they were actually going out to look for this stuff. I don't think they were looking for bombs. I think they were just looking for trinkets. So as they drove out to the woods and they were starting to have a walk around, and they suddenly noticed what looked like a mannequin just laying out in the woods.
I don't think it's a mannequin.
But as often goes with these types of stories, it's not a mannequin. It's never a mannequin. It's a body of a young man.
That's not entirely true. Sometimes it is a mannequin. Do you remember Herb Baumeister? Do you remember his swimming pool was surrounded by mannequins?
You occasionally get a story on the Daily Mail or something like that, like a body in lake found out to be mannequin or something like that.
Good old Daily Mail.
This one, yeah, but I have to use it sometime for my dodgy sources. It wasn't a mannequin. It was a body of a young man. So the men immediately left the area to get help. When the police arrived on scene, they found a young deceased male that was handcuffed and had multiple gunshot wounds to the head. They had a John Doe on their hands. And what they didn't know at the time was this wasn't the murderer's first victim. So going back in time a bit, Charles Scudder was born on the 6th of October, 1926, in Wisconsin. And after he finished high school, he went to university and got a degree in zoology, languages, chemistry, and went on to get a PhD in pharmaceuticals. He was a highly intelligent young man, and he was also interested in music, drama, art, but he ultimately decided to choose science as a career. Charles got married, so Dr. Scudder got married twice, and he had four sons with his second wife. Later on, Dr. Scudder became an associate director for the Royal University of Chicago. So it was his department was in charge of everything to do with drugs, like behavior. And they also did studies on how psychedelic drugs affected like behavior, which sounds really, okay, really cool. So later on, he'd go on to work as a professor of pharmacology at Chicago's Loyola University. He said it was a really good job, even by his own definition. He was described by those who knew him as brilliant, polished, soft-spoken, but confident. Scudder was a very eccentric person. He did things like dyed his hair bright purple, and at one point he even had a pet monkey. So for the time, it was like, purple hair? Meh. Didn't think that was a thing back then.
Yeah, so what's this now? What, the 40s?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, yeah, purple hair in the 1940s.
Yeah.
With a monkey.
That's when everything was black and white. Charles, when he was working at this university, he went on to meet a man called Joseph Odom, known as everyone as Joey, which is how what I'll call him for the rest of this story. He was born on the 27th of March, 1936. Unlike Dr. Scudder, Joey dropped out of school in the fifth grade. He fell into trouble. He got done for theft and ended up being put in prison. Actually going to prison ended up helping him, because while he was in prison, he became a chef. So how good you are as a prison chef, I don't know, but actually he was quite good at it and developed quite a passion for cooking. And once he got out of prison, it was Joan's cooking skills that would convince Dr. Scudder to hire him as a chef for his family in 1959. Charles had divorced again for a second time and was living in a mansion in Chicago's West Side with his four sons. So it was like a rough area, but Dr. Scudder really enjoyed the area and the fact that the mansion had a room for all of his things and the things that piqued his interest, which included collecting antiques, producing his own paintings, playing the harp.
Somewhere to put the monkey.
Yeah. And it also provided a lot of space for his two huge English mastiffs. And also, there was room to hold quite wild parties. Sexy parties.
Sexy parties.
So, Joey was eventually the live-in chef / nanny / maintenance guy of the home. And also, Joey and the doctor would fall in love. But it was kept secret at the time because of the stigma around it. To match his out-of-the-norm persona, Dr. Scudder joined the Church of Satan and would tell people, I'm a Satanist, and just be like, shock, shock. Just doing everything to be loved. So people would be like, excuse me? So he was just a rebel. In 1976, when his sons had grown and left home, Dr. Scudder found himself growing tired of the city life. And after the sudden death of his youngest son, this gave him another push to just leave and start something anew. As he put it, Dr. Scudder longed for an escape from the taxes, the light bills, gas bills, water bills, heating bills, and so the near 50-year-old decided to move to the country. So he purchased 40 acres of mountainous, undeveloped land in rural Georgia. But he would not go alone. Yes, the love story of Joey and Dr. Scudder was still going strong.
What about the monkey?
The monkey had moved on to other things. The monkey was no longer there, I don't think.
Okay.
What happened, I don't know. So Dr. Scudder and Joey arrived at their property that they purchased during an ice storm with their two dogs and whatever they could fit in their Jeep and small camper.
So the dogs are still there?
I don't know if it's the same dogs.
Okay.
As they attempted to reach their hilltop, the first thing they saw on their lane was the corpse of a dead horse.
Nice. Welcome home.
Yeah. Poor love. And it was blocking the logging trail. So they decided to name the lane up to their house Dead Horse Road. and the brick-like castle home that they would eventually build together in the woods would be called Corpsewood Manor. So Dr. Scudder was a fan, a massive fan of the Addams Family, which I didn't know existed then. I have no idea how long's that been out?
60s?
Well, this is the 70s now, maybe. So yeah, it must have been, it was already out then. He likened to his own taste to the lifestyles of that of the spooky clang of outsiders.
I've got to say, this guy sounds awesome.
He sounds pretty cool at the minute.
Yeah, I'm a bit concerned that... Anyway, keep going.
Everywhere we're going. So he liked the taste of the Addams Family, and every Satanist identifies with the Addams Family in one way or another.
I like the Addams Family.
Are you a Satanist? No, I'm saying that all Satanists like the Addams Family, according to this source, anyway.
Are you a Satanist and do you like the Addams Family? Write in chillers.killers.pod@gmail.com.
tell me. Yeah, so they soon nailed up their sign saying Corpsewood Manor. So that it's all dramatic when you turn up.
I love it.
I love it so far. Yeah. So over the course of 6 years, this is how long it took them to build their property in full. It was like a brick castle. So Dr. Scudder poured his heart and soul into building and cultivating their dream home. Joey, in turn, tended to a flourishing rose garden and delighted in preparing meals on a wood stove. So they're completely like off-grid.
Yeah.
They forged friendships with some of the locals who contributed fruit for Dr. Scudder's homemade wine. Amidst the tranquility of their surroundings, a wedding was even celebrated in the enchanting rose garden, accompanied by the melody of Dr. Scudder on his little harp.
Little? Have you seen a harp? They're fucking massive.
Well, a big harp. Yeah. So Dr. Scudder continued to make art, painting, creating stained glass so that they could sell it and also decorate the home. These are all incorporated to all of the windows in the house. Nice. Most notoriously, he created a stained glass Baphomet sigil, which is the symbol of the Church of Satan.
If you say so.
Did you know that?
I'm not a Satanist.
Well,
so.
that's what that is. So Dr. Scudder's interest in the occult could also be seen in the pentagrams that he painted on the doors of his black Jeep and in the catalogues of books later found in the house. He also made no secret of his Satanism. While Joey always protested that he himself was Catholic, Dr. Scudder was open about his beliefs, clarifying misconceptions. So if anyone was like, he's not a Satanist, he was like, actually, I am. This forest sanctuary was now Scudder's way to just completely express himself, and with Joey as well. But Scudder was the extrovert of the couple. Mansion in the middle of the woods. Two massive mastiffs. Are they the same ones? Are they not? I don't know. But the mastiffs, the first one's called Beelzebub. Beelzebub.
Beelzebub.
Beelzebub, and the second one is Arsenath.
Yeah.
So the first one is named after a demon, and the other is a H.P. Lovecraft character. Local legend adds to this, saying that they also apparently summoned a demon to help protect the property, along with the mastiffs. The rest of the mansion was decorated using skulls that Scudder had stolen from his university job. A pink gargoyle that was retrieved from his previous residence. Scudder himself loved to say that the manor is more like a mausoleum or a tomb in need of constant care, cleaning and costly upkeep. While Dr. Scudder took his Satanism seriously, he didn't worship Satan. Instead, he was a staunch atheist who chose to celebrate the base worldly pleasures that the other churches and religions forbade. So what could he indulge himself in that normally religion is a bit like, no.
Is it murder?
No, not murder. Not quite. So the professor's house was off limits to visitors. So when they had people over, they would entertain their guests on the third floor of an outbuilding that they called the chicken house. So the third floor room, so you had to go in a ladder to go up to the top. It was painted all pink and they called it the pink room. He liked to invite guests over for sexy sex parties in the pink room, which was filled with mattresses, candles, whips, chains, and even a logbook listing guests' sexual desires. I don't know why I'm going all weird.
It's a bit seedy, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. And also, where they are, it's super rural, super backcountry. That lacked excitement during the late 1970s and early 1980s. Economic downturn cast a shadow over the town, leaving little in the way of entertainment or activities. Obviously, most locals are quite religious and showed complete disdain for Dr. Scudder and Joey, and they just called them the homosexual devil worshippers.
But Joey's not, he's Catholic.
He's a chef. He just wants to tend his garden and cook meals for everybody. So with all these young people with nothing to do, what they ended up doing is that they used to go riding. So they go in their car or on their bikes and just like ride around. A lot of them didn't have any money to actually do anything. So they were all seeking amusement. And eventually they started discovering this random mansion in the middle of the woods. And Dr. Scudder was always super nice, perfect host. Like, occasionally he'd share his homemade wine with them. He was also into a lot of drugs, was Mr. Dr. Scudder. So he had a lot of psychedelics around.
From his job.
And alcohol. Yeah, he knew how to do that. It was like peace and love, basically anything goes. So, like, people would randomly turn up and he would, like, entertain them. But only in the chicken house or in the garden, never in the main property. So among the locals that Dr. Scudder and Joey befriended was 17-year-old Kenneth Avery Brock and his roommate, 30-year-old Samuel Tony West. It cannot be confirmed, but some people say that Avery may have had several sexual encounters with Dr. Scudder at the mansion over a few weeks. And other accounts claim that they had merely gotten permission from Dr. Scudder and Joey to hunt on the property. So it's like conflicting.
That's not the same thing.
A lot of this is local rumours.
It's not even close. They're either shagging or hunting. Those are the options, not the same thing.
Yeah. So after befriending them on their estate, Avery came to believe that they were much wealthier than they actually were. Avery's roommate, Tony West, strongly objected to any kind of sexual activity with the couples. He was totally against it. He may have also convinced Avery that he had been taken advantage of by the doctor. Avery and Tony eventually decided to return to the mansion to rob them. So on the 16th of December 1982, Tony West and Avery Brock ventured up to Copswood, accompanied by two of their friends, Joey Wells and Teresa Hudgens, a young couple that was out for a casual evening, just like going out on a date. And they didn't have their car, so they decided to go with Tony and Avery for the night. So they went up to the mansion where they believed that Dr. Scudder was hiding immense wealth. It's like treasure everywhere. So they just kind of saw it that they could go in, take the doctor and Joey out and just live there themselves. And that no one would say anything because they were homosexual and no one wanted them in there anyway.
What, like kill them or just like...
No, just like be like, actually, we're living here now.
That's weird.
Yeah. Anyway, so upon reaching the mansion, Dr. Scudder comes out, warmly welcomes his random guests, just randomly turning up his house. So he went and settled them into the pink room for a sexual party. He offered them wine, and then the atmosphere was further influenced by the use of a tootaloo. So tootaloo is a makeshift method of intoxication involving inhaling paint thinner and glue soaked into a rag. So you're just kind of sniffing this rag. So amidst drinking and the conversation, the two teenage guests, so Joey Wells and Teresa, went and slumped off to a corner to have a little bit of fun. And then Scudder was just chatting away with Tony and Avery. After a while, Avery went out of the building and he just left. He just needed to get some air. So Scudder was just chilling and chatting to everyone. What he didn't know that Avery had gone outside to the car to retrieve a rifle that he'd borrowed earlier from his mother. It had belonged to his father. And then when he came back to the pink room, he pointed the gun at Dr. Scudder and told him to stand up. The other man, Tony, then pressed a knife to Dr. Scudder, bound and gagged him, and marched him off to the main property. After entering, Dr. Scudder was horrified to see Joey's lifeless body on the floor. Avery had actually been and shot Joey just before coming back to the chicken house, and he'd also shot the two dogs. Tony and Avery then threatened and beat Dr. Scudder as they attempted to find out where the money was. They actually made him step over Joey's body and were trying to force him into different rooms, asking where the money, where's the money, where's the money. Earlier that day, Dr. Scudder had been playing his harp and had used a high battery-powered portable stereo to record himself playing and reciting the words to William Blake's The Tiger. It was meant to be a gift for a friend. And as the perpetrators were running through the house, ransacking the whole thing, they mistakenly hit play on the stereo. And in like a horrifying twist of fate, like a horror film, you could hear booming out of the stereo Dr. Scudder's sonorous voice coming out to with the harp playing in the background. It was like soundtrack to this horrible crime that was happening. As Avery and Tony were starting to realise that Scudder was actually telling the truth and they don't have money and they've done this for no reason whatsoever, they gradually started to accept that, and then they pushed Scudder to the ground and shot him 5 times in the head. They took what little valuables were lying around and fled the scene, stealing Dr. Scudder's Jeep as well. Avery and Tony fled all the way to Mississippi, which is where we were in the beginning of the story, where they would eventually rob and kill a man named Kirby Phelps. They killed him as part of a robbery gone wrong and dumped his body in the woods.
They're a bit trigger happy, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, let's just kill everybody.
Mm-hmm. So after this, Avery returned to Georgia and turned himself into the police, perhaps feeling remorseful. But I don't know if he was remorseful for the first murders or whether it was the second one that just tipped him over. I'm not sure. And then 5 days later, Tony West did the same thing. Eventually, Tony was found guilty on 2 counts of murder and sentenced to death. So that's the older of the two.
Mm.
Whilst Avery pleaded guilty and received 3 consecutive life terms. So they're both not getting out. So with this comes the end of this strange and bloody story of Copsewood Manor murders. But lots of questions remain about, like, why? If they were going to rob them, why murder Joey first? And why would they think that they could just move into someone's house and murder them and that no one would say anything? Because, yes, a lot of the locals called them the homosexual Satan lovers, but they also had loads of friends in the area. I don't understand where they were going and why they thought that they'd get away with it. And also, what was weird is the doctor had just had a portrait of himself done a few months prior where he is pictured gagged with bullets in his head. But it's as if he had a portrait of his own death.
Of the future.
Before the death happened. The Tony West, he said that he didn't have really any remorse. He says that they were devils and I killed them and I did the world a favour. And like the bigoted rumours and also just how it was viewed at the time to be a homosexual. It was just everything was going against the trial to possibly get them lesser sentences, but they still got the heavy ones anyway. These two men left behind friends who loved them. Those people are still visiting the remains of Corpsewood and keeping it clean, quiet, and beautiful. Charles Scudder and Joey Odom were different. They were outsiders, they're murderers, and many of those who weighed in afterwards with their stupid rumours vilified the victims as devils and deserving of their fate.
That's horrible.
When really, you know, if anything, they were just two weirdos from the big city, but like weirdos in the best way.
Yeah, just eccentric, just different.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're not perfect, but yeah, no, that's my story this week.
Well, thanks. That was mental. It was really good. Really good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Right. Shall we go?
Yes.
We would love for you to follow us on social media. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, or now X at @SCSK_podcast. You can also follow us on Facebook. Our page is called Spine Chillers and Serial Killers, and we have a YouTube channel that is also called Spine Chillers and Serial Killers.
And then if you want to email, you can also email chillers.killers.pod@gmail.com.
And please do, we want some listener stories. Something creepy has happened to you.
Or just anything, honestly, a story. Even if it's a feel-good one, just tell us stuff.
Tell us stuff. Anything. Stay safe.
Don't kill people.
And keep it weird. Bye.
Don't let the frost bite. Bye. Ooh, big summer blowout. Just stop waving my arms around.
You're dicking about, you're slapping the mic. I think you should leave. Fair.
Dicking about, slapping my microphone. You're making it sound. Right. I'll sit on my hands.